Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on this 21st day of November 2011. And once again, we are talking to regular weekly guest Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster at intforecaster.com. Bob Chapman, always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you, as always, for gracing us with your presence.
Well, gee, that sounds wonderful. And I thank you very much, and all of the other agencies that carry our work. And I think probably the main point here today again is the situation in Europe. What most people don't know, because they've never lived in Europe, that from around December the 7th until around the 10th of January, Europe just goes into a trance. A holiday trance, just like they did during late July and all through August. In other words, the precedent of the time is let's take time off. No, that does not help the problems financially and economically in Europe at this time. It just makes the road rockier. We just had an election in Spain where the new president said that he is going to get employment going and that he's going to attempt to fix this financial problem. Well, I give him my best regards and luck, and he's got his work cut out. 7 years of a socialist government, their attitude is too loose, and that just adds to the problem. They're not conservative about anything. I guess that's apropos. But the last administration, and it seems like yesterday, was in the middle of the road or slightly to the left as well. And I guess Europeans in general like their politics that way. You don't see many what we would consider conservatives in Europe. It's just the way they think. But anyway, I don't think that Spain's problems are going to be solved in any quick manner whatsoever. Are they going to get unemployment down? The only way they can do that is by listening to Washington and throw money at it. And that's probably what they'll do. And at the same time, they'll try to solve the financial problems, which are unsolvable. And things are going to remain about the same at best, not only in Europe and England, but also in the United States as well. If we don't have an increase in unemployment in the U.S., I'd be very surprised. Worldwide, we have a slowing economy. It's identified itself first in Germany and some of the other cash-positive countries, we'll call them, and in England and in the United States. But even more so, we're starting to see it in Asia, in China, in Japan, Brazil. And so even though the economies have been going down for a minimum of 3 months in Europe, I think others will follow. And incidentally, Europe is China's biggest customer, U.S. is second biggest. And so I think that in time, what you're going to see here, and it's not something I'll go into here, but I think you're going to see a breakdown eventually because of not being able to compete or afford foreign goods, that you're going to see a move towards tariffs. And I think that is really imminent. We're talking about the United States and England in particular. I think Europe will follow along those lines, but they'll be forced to. So that is the overall picture. underneath all of that, we have the solvent countries in Europe telling the others behind closed doors, you people are on your own. And I think they're going to let them all go bankrupt because the amounts of money that are going to be needed to keep them going sideways of between $4 and $6 trillion, and those solvent countries, they just cannot afford to do that without destroying their own economies. And so I think they're going to be let loose one by one, and that'll encompass the next probably 6 months to a year. At the same time, they're trying to consolidate and make stronger the 8 or 10 countries that are going to be left in the Eurozone. And I think that from a Euro point of view is fine as far as they're concerned, but I think it's doomed to failure, just like the Euro was from the very beginning. But more importantly, in that formalization, we're looking at a move, particularly by Mrs. Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, towards more consolidation and giving up more of sovereignty among the stronger nations, supposedly to make the system function better. Well, all it's going to do is lead Europe down a blind alley, because what this is all about is world government. And what they're going to try to do is have a 8-member board oversee, with technocrats and bureaucrats from Brussels, all of the internal flex that's in their systems within their own countries. In other words, what they want to do is take the ability of, say, Germany, to do its own budget and run its own country fiscally away from it. They want to do it with the others and eventually all 28 members. And so what they're using here is a crisis to interject something really, what I think is horrible. And I lived over there for many years, so I know the thought processes that go on over there in the different countries. And I think they're probably going to get away with it. And I fear for the people of Europe, because once that's in, they've lost it. I mean, they take orders from a bunch of goons in Brussels who could care less what goes on in Bavaria or in Bielefeld. And so I think what's going to happen here is a further deterioration of the zone. And when they find out that they really can't effectively coordinate the fiscal projections of the people in these other countries, they're going to find out that they got a serious problem again. And so we could be looking at a year and a half or two, maybe a little longer, and I think the Europe will come down and they will find that they can't make that system work. And that's based upon the electorate in Germany in particular, okaying this, or the elected representatives. I don't know when they stand for election again in Germany, but it can't be soon enough, because the people are in there. They sold out their constituencies. I mean, these people do not want this. And so you're going to see things happen in Germany down the line that you're seeing today in Egypt, with hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating, and also now in Greece and in other countries. And so it very much affects America. And America has been doing the same thing, if not more, in trying to save their economy. It's not working, and it hasn't worked. Trillions of dollars have been spent, and in both areas, Europe, England, and the United States, the banks, the financial sector, again and again gets bailed out. The public assumes their losses, and it can't continue. It just simply can't continue. And so the news is not good. It's not going to get better. And that's just the way it is.
Well, a rather bleak assessment, but I think probably a fair one. And as you point out, I think it is going to be the European peoples who are hurt the most by all of this, no matter which way it plays out, whether it's the hard crash or the soft, long, prolonged crash. It's going to still hurt the average person more than, of course, the banksters and technocrats who, as we see, are already putting themselves into positions of power and assuming even more power on the back of this crisis. So I guess that leaves the question of what do you think is the real prescription for this? If you were trying to coach the peoples of Greece or Spain or Germany or any of these other affected countries, what would you suggest to them, given the fact that we've seen, for example, Papandreou's idea for the referendum was promptly withdrawn and that there is really no people's input into this whole austerity process? What would you suggest the peoples of Europe really can or should be doing at this point?
Year on year, the sales of gold in Europe are up 135%. And to me, that's chicken feed. I don't think they really started to get it going yet. But if you live in Europe, you want to be buying gold and silver coins, bullion, and shares. It is your only safe haven. Because if you look at what happened during the 1930s, and this is going to be worse, losses in the Dow Jones were around 90%. Losses and other things varied from 60 to 100%. And today I think we're faced with the same kind of equations. The only thing to perform well was gold and gold shares during that period of time. And the same thing happens when you have inflation, good performance by them. And so the only place they've got to go with the euros, never mind the other currencies that are of lesser quality. People should be, with their extra money, buying gold and silver-related assets. It's the only safe place to be. Because let's say everything lost 75%, and even gold didn't perform, and it went down 25%, you're still better off. Now, I don't expect that to happen, but I'm giving you the other side of the coin, so to speak. So you've got to be prepared, and that's the only way you can do it.
Well, as long as they're not buying futures from MF Global, I suppose.
Well, I think you've got a point there. And I'm just wondering why Mr. Corzine and his band of merry men did what they did. These guys are real pros. And it's hard for me to imagine for that to go against the market and get decimated. And then there's the matter of the receiver taking cash out of accounts, and we don't know where the cash went because nobody will tell us. And then we have a lawsuit filed on Friday against seven brokerage firms that did a bond underwriting for MF Global. They're being sued by pension funds. The ramifications here could be quite deep. We really don't know the details. They're not telling us anything. We have not seen Corzine's name anywhere for 2 or 3 weeks. It's like he fell off a cliff into eternity. So he's deliberately being protected by the major media. And you see about Global in the media, but you don't hear about him. So something big is going on here. I think a number of players are guilty in this that are not suspected to be guilty in it. And then the big question is this really a civil case or is it a criminal case? I mean, what are they putting together behind the scenes here that we don't know about? Why haven't they freed up people's accounts to them? You know, normally in the commodities business, when a firm goes under, the accounts are allocated out, sometimes to one firm, sometimes to several. And they continue to do business as normally. This is the only case I've ever known where they said, we're not going to pass these accounts on to anybody. I don't know, maybe because they didn't want them. they the other commodity houses, or what they're doing with them. This number is bantied around 600 million to 1.2 billion is missing. And we still don't know anything about that. Where is the CFTC? Where is the SEC? Where is the Federal Bureau of Investigation? I mean, are they all hiding somewhere? If they're doing something, it would be nice if they'd let us know about it. One of the things people should understand, and I've been in these businesses for 30 years, and I've been around them a total of 53 years. So there's not an awful lot of living people who have more experience in this area than I do as an expert. And we're looking at a commodity exchange where your contract was never worth the paper it was written on. And I have admonished people for years and years, don't go there. Well, some people chose to, obviously. And that is totally different. And I get this question coming up all the time. That's why I'm quickly going to address it. And that is that in the brokerage houses, in the area of stocks and bonds, you have CIPIC insurance from the U.S. government, and there has never been an instance when a company went under that their accounts the same day were not transferred to another company or another group of companies. And so you don't stand the fearful consequences that you've seen at a commodity house, MF Global. You won't see that in regular stock and bond accounts. So you don't have to run down and liquidate your account because somebody's going to steal your stock. Or you don't have to take delivery. No one's going to take your stock. You're safe. Unless the rules are changed, and I don't envision them changing them. And you got to remember, the people who are in Wall Street, they'd like to stay in business. And they like making a good living. And so I think those rules, which are very strong, are going to stay in force. And so don't be concerned. And hopefully that will cut down. I had 1,240 emails this morning, many of them about this subject, and I didn't know why I'm talking about it. I want to cut that number down.
I can certainly understand that, especially given your policy of responding to everyone. That's almost unthinkable. But going back to what you said earlier, I think you're exactly right to try to take a look at the way the media's reaction to this story tells us something about the story itself, as is so often the case. Looking at the mainstream media is really only useful insofar as it tells us what the power elites want us to think about a story. And if you just do a Google experiment, I'm right now on Google News, of all places, typing in John Corzine. And from when this story first broke around November 4th, there were 4,395 news articles related to that. From about 4 days ago, there's 587 news articles related to John Corzine. From 3 days ago, 33 news articles. And from today, 4 news articles. I think as the MF Global story is growing, John Corzine's name seems to be fading away from the spotlight in all of this. And I think that must tell us something about where people don't want us to be looking right now.
I think you're right, and it is a continuing problem among people who belong to the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberger Group, the Illuminati. They all protect each other. You never see them go to jail. If anything, if they get caught with their hand in the cookie jar, what happens is that the company is fined, but they're not. But if they are, the company pays it anyway. And so with that said, we have a two-tier system of justice, one for the wealthy, connected, internationalist types within the banking and financial world and in the transnational corporation world as well. And then there's the rest of us. I mean, right now, in Europe, in England, and the United States, banks are keeping two sets of books. If you and I had a company and we kept two sets of books, we would quickly end up in jail. Now, why are they allowed to do that? Because they're special. Why are banks too big to fail? Because banks, big ones especially, are the power seat. This is from where all their power emanates, is from the banking sector. And as I've said before, I know it's going to be painful, but it's going to be painful anyway. Let the system go down. And they lose their control. And that's very, very, very important.
Well, that's really the key, isn't it? Because as you point out, it is a system that unfortunately is run by and for the cronies who have managed to centralize their power. And on that note, back in the American context, in just looking at last Saturday's issue of The Forecaster, I'm looking at page 7 here, where you're talking about the new super committee in Congress or above Congress or whatever they are exactly, and their secret farm bill that they're trying to pass. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
The extent of what I know is what I put in there. I don't have any information beyond that because it's behind the scenes. They hide everything. But they want this enabling committee, as I call it, which is patented after the Soviet Politburo, the 1933 Enabling Act in Germany, passed by the National Socialist Party, and what was used to bypass Congress to put Hitler in power and to consolidate Joe Stalin's power as well. We're not only seeing it in the United States with these 12 members, who I think they're very disappointed they couldn't come to some conclusion. Obviously, not all of them were bought and paid for in total. Otherwise, you would have had a decision. Over in Europe, they're putting together in the ESM, this is something new that you haven't heard about unless you read my publication, 8 members, and they're going to make all the decisions, and they're going to bypass all of the congresses. It's toward world dictatorial government. And unless you know what these people are up to, and understand what they've done for centuries, you won't understand this. And that's why we need more and more people to study this. Because what it is, in football you call it an end run. And what these panels are doing is they're end running legislatures, houses of representatives and senates and so on, worldwide, to make it look like something's happening when in fact it's not. The same old dictator's in place, whether you call him the dictator or not. And that's what we've had over and over again since the mid to late 1800s in Europe, and then it came to America. And you can call it what you may, Marxist, socialism, fascism, and all of the branches that come off of that. But in order to get people docilized and ready for world government, they give them all these isms to run around and chase. And if you haven't studied what they're up to, there's no difference between any of the groups. They're all headed in the same direction, world government. And so these groups are all created, just like Stalin was financed originally from, obviously, Marx and Lenin were originally funded from England. And the British, but more so the United States, was instrumental in funding Adolf Hitler. And these are a matter of historical fact that they haven't been able to expunge yet. But this is their relentless, ongoing continuation of trying to control everyone in the world, and it really means enslavement. And if you people don't wake up out there, you're going to wake up one morning and they say, well, we decided, Mr. Jones, that you're going to work in San Francisco, and Mrs. Jones is going to work in Miami, the kids are going to go to school in Chicago, you don't need the house anymore, we'll take care of it, your cars, you're not going to need them either, and we got some cars on the other end for you. And we're going to confiscate anything that you have that we want. That's where it's all headed. And I've been looking at this for 53 years, and finally we're making some headway and making people understand how this is about and what it is about.
Well, that's such an insightful comment that you had there about the process by which this is done, the docilization of society in order to get people chasing the isms that all lead to the same goal, which of course is the globalists' grand goal of complete consolidation of control in their hands across all nation-state boundaries. And that's ultimately where all of these different isms that they give us to chase around are heading. So I think it's important to understand that. And it's also important to understand that mental enslavement is really the first and maybe the primary goal of enslavement itself, because no one is more enslaved than those who think they are free. So I think that has to be taken in its context of this overlying power structure that's been created. And that sends my mind spinning off in a number of different directions. But I suppose one of the overall arching systems of control that they have is that process of docilization. So, I mean, it's a question of mentally combating that. And I think one of the tricks that they love to use is to play on our own expectation that somehow dictatorship is going to come in the form of a man, you know, in a brown uniform with a red armband with a little mustache, goose stepping. But it's not going to look like that. It's going to look like whatever we want it to look like, a man in a three-piece suit with a 1,000-watt smile or whatever it is that society thinks, you know, commands respect. So what can you say to that attitude that people have that they just can't believe that this is happening?
Now, that's what brainwashing and propagandization is all about. It started around the turn of the last century. It really, really got underway with Deweyism in the school systems in the United States, and other countries followed that unfortunate example, and which is the teaching down, the zombieization of the use of the human mind. And what has put people in is into a state where they don't want to realize, they don't want to face what's going on. It's called a flight from reality. And then they get into what is called denial. And that's the stage we're in now. And people will branch off and they'll black it out of their mind or blank it out of their mind. And or they'll throw themselves deeply into their work or deeply into religion in order to block this out. And the relentless propaganda, particularly in television, major media networks, continues unabated. I mean, you don't get any of the discussion that we're talking about here on general television. They just wouldn't allow it. And, you know, who's going to answer someone like me when I bring these things up? And because, you know, they're in a pickle because this fellow knows what he's talking about and it's truth and how do we combat it? But there will always be a section of society that cannot come out of the torpor. They can't ever reach outside of being docilized. And that's true through history. In every country, that's just the way it is. And so you have a small percentage of people who reach out and try to save society from these bankers. And they're really the major culprits. They are the people who want this world government. And this is their power hold. Who's behind the banks? Well, we have aristocratic families such as the Rothschilds, and then we have the royal houses of Europe. And then we have their descendants in America and Australia and Canada and New Zealand, et cetera. And you've got this sort of thing droning upon the people all the time. And quite frankly, most of them don't know which end is up unless they're really ready to jump outside that box and say, gee, there must be more to this than this. And I'm not going to go into denial. I'm going to think about it. And that's how people come about understanding what we do here on this program and a number of others, but not enough.
Not nearly enough, never enough, of course, but growing every day, and that's really the point. Well, let's broaden our perspective a little here, because we've touched on Europe and we've touched on the American context, but I think there's another context to this which we've seen growing in importance lately and has been being touted even more so by the power players like Secretary Clinton and others, and that's the Asia-Pacific region, which, of course, Hillary Clinton was saying is going to be the focus of the 21st century, the center of gravity for politics in the 21st century, and I think she might be onto something there. It's something that's being talked about by more and more people now as just the demographics of the situation and the behemoth that is China and India start to, I think, take that center of gravity. So let's see, how do they nexus into this? Because, for example, we were just talking about the Rothschilds and the European royalty and their American descendants, and of course those people who we know have been in positions of power and puppeteering world events for centuries now. How do things like the Japanese imperial family or the Chinese communist dynasty, how do they play into this? And where do those, are these just puppets? Are these puppets that could potentially start to challenge their puppet masters? What kind of relationship is going on here?
Well, as far as Japan is concerned, you're not going to find this in the history books. But they made a deal at the end of the war. And if you notice, only one person was hung. That was Tojo. The royal family made the deal that we're not going to call ourselves a royal family anymore, and we're not going to run the country. It's going to be run, quote, democratically. And there'll be two parties, and they'll control everything, and they'll take turns, and everything will be watched over and supervised from the United States. And really, that's how this thing has evolved in Japan. If you look at the companies that are in power in Japan today as transnationals, they're the same people that built the tanks and the Zeros, Mitsubishi, et cetera, the same people, fascistic is what you would call them, that were in power in the 20s and 30s that are in power today. But they don't talk about that because these guys made a deal. In fact, they even split 50-50. All of the stuff that the Japanese stole over, I don't know, 15-year period, maybe 20 years. And so what happens to Japan is a process that in part is overseen by the people in power behind the scenes, both in the United States and Europe. China is different. Mao Zedong was put in power in 1948 by the U.S. government. It was either him or Chiang Kai-shek. And most people don't even know who these people are today because they didn't live through that. I did. And Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan and they defended Taiwan against the daily bombardment from Communist China. And Communist China has a common term, and what that is, it's an enabling committee, and you've got a group of people, I don't know the size of it, and they make all the decisions. That's the end of it. I mean, the party runs the whole country. So what you have is a combination of fascism, socialism, and capital investment, we'll call it. Yes, the biggest problem is they have a population problem. Japan doesn't have that problem. Unfortunately, like in Europe, the United States, people are dying off. In China, they're building cities with nobody in them. They're still making televisions and stockpiling them. They have created booms in the stock market, which ended about three or so years ago. And it's close to its bottoms again. And the government has been going in with pension money and propping up the stock market, and they haven't been very successful. The property market's a bubble. It's going to collapse. It's starting to go down in value. Will it happen in 2012? Probably. It's not funny, but, that's where all roads lead to. And then you have this endemic corruption, just like you have in London, Frankfurt, New York, and so on, that has to be dealt with. These people who are in the Communist Party, they get anything they want because they're party members. It was just like in Soviet Russia. If you belong to the party and you do what you're supposed to do, you get benefits that nobody else did. And the same was true in Germany. And so you have these processes of things going on in many countries which are very similar. And to put a country on a viable economic and financial footing can only be done by exiting the system. And that's what's going on now, but it's being forced upon Europe now because they made so many mistakes right from the very beginning. And so that catalyst is going to cause immense financial problems throughout the world over the next several years, and particularly over the next 2 years. And if they can't pull out of it, we'll have just a general collapse in the banking system, which I think we will. And that will go from Europe to England to the United States to China and Japan and on and on. And it's already showing up. I know recent figures in the U.S. have looked acceptable, but you can't tell from figures because they lie about everything. You don't know for sure whether those are true figures. The rest of the world, generally speaking, has been going downhill since last March or April. And we predicted this was going to happen simply because they were all using that quaint term quantitative easing, which is the creation of money and credit and from out of thin air, mind you. And, you know, if you look back at history, you know it cannot work. But yet they're doing it anyway. Well, why are they doing it? Because they have another agenda. That's world government. And they're going to come in and say, wow, we can solve these problems, not telling anybody or reminding them that we're the guys that caused the problems in the first place. And they're going to go about their way trying to do that. So that's why the destruction of the banking system as we know it is extraordinarily important, because it's the key to turning this thing around. And things are not going to get better. They're going to get worse because the people in charge want them that way so they can control us. So there's a lot more to this than meets the eye.
As there always is, isn't there? There's always the agenda at play. And I think, it's a good thing that we have voices like yours out there cutting through the propaganda and helping to educate the people on the things that a lot of people just aren't getting anywhere else. So on that note, let's talk a little bit about the International Forecaster and how people can get a copy.
The Forecaster is about business, finance, economics, social and political issues all over the world. This is my second career, 23 years doing this. We publish on Wednesdays and Saturdays by email. It runs around 35 to 40 pages normally, each time. And we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the Internet. And everything you need to know each week is in that publication. If you'd like to get a free introductory copy, you can go to theinternationalforecaster.com. TheInternational, FORECASTER.com. You can also go to www.INTFORECASTER.com, intoforecaster.com. For those of you who want to ask a question, and we answer everyone, if you'd like to get a copy of either publication, or if you'd like to get a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares, email us, and that address is Bob, B-O-B, at INTFORECASTER.com, Bob at INTFORECASTER.com. And for those of you who would like to call toll-free, that number is 877-479-8178, 877-479-8178. That's toll-free. You can get a copy of either of the publications. And if you'd like to subscribe, they have a free offer there for a one-year subscription. The deal that they're offering is terrific. So if you want to be a subscriber, please take advantage of it.
Well, you know, Bob, the thing that I like about the Forecaster is that you still have the power to surprise me. And just as an explanation of that, I'll just point people to last Saturday's edition of the newsletter, which actually opens with a quote from Trump, I assume Donald Trump, explaining Obamacare. And I never thought I'd say this, but it's actually quite a brilliant quotation. So I'll just leave it at that for people who haven't checked it out yet. But I thought that was very surprising, but very, very apropos and very funny and very insightful.
You never know where you're going to find those pearls.
You never know. Oh, yeah. Strangest places sometimes. Well, at any rate, let's leave it there for now. Bob, I'm looking forward to next week's surprises, so thanks once again.
Well, thank you, and I'm looking forward as well, and thank you all for listening.